the plight of Soviet dissidents, on enemy killings in Cambodia, and on the Bulgarian connection helped weaken the Vietnam syndrome, justify a huge arms buildup and a more aggressive foreign policy, and divert attention from the upward distribution of income that was the heart of Reagan's domestic economic program. The recent propaganda disinformation attacks on Nicaragua have been needed to avert eyes from the savagery of the war in El Salvador and to justify the escalating U.S. investment in counter-revolution in Central America. Conversely, propaganda campaigns will not be mobilized where victimization, even though massive, sustained, and dramatic, fails to meet the test of utility to elite interests. Thus, while the focus on Cambodia in the Pol Pot era and thereafter was exceedingly serviceable, as Cambodia had fallen to the communists and useful lessons could be drawn by attention to their victims, the numerous victims of the U.S. bombing before the communist takeover were scrupulously ignored by the U.S. elite press. After Pol Pot's ouster by the Vietnamese, the United States quietly shifted support to this worse-than-Hitler villain with little notice in the press, which adjusted once again to the national political agenda. Attention to the Indonesian massacres of 1965-66 or the victims of the Indonesian invasion of East Timor from 1975 onward would also be distinctly unhelpful as bases of media campaigns because Indonesia is a U.S. ally and client that maintains an open door to Western investment, and because, in the case of East Timor, the United States bears major responsibility for the slaughter. The same is true of the victims of state terror in Chile and Guatemala, U.S. clients whose basic institutional structures, including the state terror system, were put in place and maintained by, or with crucial assistance from, U.S. power, and who remain U.S. client states. Propaganda campaigns on behalf of these victims would conflict with the government business military interests and, in our model, would not be able to pass through the filtering system. Propaganda campaigns may be instituted either by the government or by one or more of the top media firms. The campaigns to discredit the government of Nicaragua, to support the Salvadoran elections as an exercise in legitimizing democracy, and to use the Soviet shooting down of the Korean airliner KAL-007 as a means of mobilizing public support for the arms buildup, were instituted and propelled by the government. The campaigns to publicize the crimes of Pol Pot and the alleged KGB plot to assassinate the Pope were initiated by the Reader's Digest, with strong follow-up support from NBC TV, The New York Times, and other major media companies. Some propaganda campaigns are jointly initiated by government and media. All of them require the collaboration of the mass media. The secret of the unidirectionality of the politics of media propaganda campaigns is the multiple filter system discussed earlier. The mass media will allow any stories that are hurtful to large interests to peter out quickly, if they surface at all. For stories that are useful, the process will get underway with a series of government leaks, press conferences, white papers, etc., or with one or more of the mass media starting the ball rolling with such articles as Barron and Paul's Murder of a Gentle Land, Cambodia, or Claire Sterling's The Plot to Kill the Pope, both in the Reader's Digest. If the other major media like the story, they will follow it up with their own versions, and the matter quickly becomes newsworthy by familiarity. If the articles are written in an assured and convincing style, are subject to no criticisms or alternative interpretations in the mass media, and command support by authority figures, the propaganda themes quickly become established as true, even without real evidence. This tends to close out dissenting views even more comprehensively, as they would now conflict with an already established popular belief. This in turn opens up further opportunities for still more inflated claims, as these can be made without fear of serious repercussions. Similar wild assertions made in contradiction of official views would elicit powerful flack, so that such an inflation process would be controlled by the government and the market. No such protections exist with the system-supportive claims. There, flack will tend to press the media to greater hysteria in the face of enemy evil. The media not only suspend critical judgment and investigative zeal, they compete to find ways of putting the newly established truth in a supportive light. themes and facts, even careful and well-documented analyses, that are incompatible with the now institutionalized theme are suppressed or ignored. If the theme collapses of its own burden of fabrications, the mass media will quietly fold their tents and move on to another topic. Using a propaganda model, we would not only anticipate definitions of worth based on utility and dichotomous attention based on the same criterion, we would also expect the news stories about worthy and unworthy victims, or enemy and friendly states, to differ in quality. That is, we would expect official sources of the United States and its client regimes to be used heavily and uncritically in connection with one's own abuses and those of friendly governments, while refugees and other dissident sources will be used in dealing with enemies. We would anticipate the uncritical acceptance of certain premises in dealing with self and friends, such as that one's own state and leaders seek peace and democracy, oppose terrorism, and tell the truth, premises which will not be applied in treating enemy states. We would expect different criteria of evaluation to be employed, so that what is villainy in enemy states will be presented as an incidental background fact in the case of oneself and friends. What is on the agenda in treating one case will be off the agenda in discussing the other. We would also expect great investigatory zeal in the search for enemy villainy and the responsibility of high officials for abuses in enemy states, but diminished enterprise in examining such matters in connection with one's own and friendly states. The quality of coverage should also be displayed more directly and crudely in placement, headlining, word usage, and other modes of mobilizing interest and outrage. In the opinion columns, we would anticipate sharp restraints on the range of opinion allowed expression. Our hypothesis is that worthy victims will be featured prominently and dramatically, that they will be humanized, and that their victimization will receive the detail and context in story construction that will generate listener interest and sympathetic emotion. In contrast, unworthy victims will merit only slight detail, minimal humanization, and little context that will excite and enrage. Meanwhile, because of the power of establishment sources, the flak machines, and anti-communist ideology, we would anticipate outcries that the worthy victims are being sorely neglected, that the unworthy are treated with excessive and uncritical generosity, that the media's liberal, adversarial, if not subversive, hostility to government explains our difficulties in mustering support for the latest national venture in counter-revolutionary intervention. In sum, a propaganda approach to media coverage suggests a systematic and highly political dichotomization in news coverage based on serviceability to important domestic power interests. This should be observable in dichotomized choices of story and in the volume and quality of coverage. In the chapters that follow, we will see that such dichotomization in the mass media is massive and systematic. Not only are choices for publicity and suppression comprehensible in terms of system advantage, but the modes of handling favored and inconvenient materials, placement, tone, context, fullness of treatment, differ in ways that serve political ends. Chapter 2: Worthy and Unworthy Victims. A propaganda system will consistently portray people abused in enemy states as worthy victims, whereas those treated with equal or greater severity by its own government or clients will be unworthy. The evidence of worth may be read from the extent and character of attention and indignation. We will show in this chapter that the U.S. mass media's practical definitions of worth are political in the extreme and fit well with expectations of a propaganda model. While this differential treatment occurs on a large scale, the media, intellectuals, and public are able to remain unconscious of the fact and maintain a high moral and self-righteous tone. This is evidence of an extremely effective propaganda system. 2.1. Jerzy Popiełuszko versus 100 Religious Victims in Latin America. A useful comparison can be made between the mass media's treatment of Jerzy Popiełuszko, a Polish priest murdered by the Polish police in October 1984, and the media's coverage of priests murdered within the U.S. sphere of influence. In our model, Popiełuszko, murdered in an enemy state, will be a worthy victim, whereas priests murdered in our client states in Latin America will be unworthy. The former may be expected to elicit a propaganda outburst by the mass media. The latter will not generate sustained coverage. 2.1.1 Quantitative Aspects of Coverage. Consider the coverage of Pope Yahushko's murder and the trial of his murderers by the New York Times, Time and Newsweek, and CBS News. The Pope Yahushko murder had 72 articles, compared with the same media given to religious personnel murdered in Latin America by agents of U.S. client states. The coverage given 72 individuals in a list of Latin American religious martyrs named by Penny Lernoux in her book Cry of the People. Media coverage of 23 priests, missionaries, and other religious workers murdered in Guatemala between January 1980 and February 1985 were given a total of 57 articles. The coverage of the Pope Yahushko murder not only dwarfs that of the unworthy victims, it constitutes a major episode of news management and propaganda. Nothing comparable can be found for victims within the free world. It can be seen that the New York Times featured the Pope Yahushko case on its front page on 10 different occasions, and the intensity of coverage assured that its readers would know who Pope Yahushko was, that he had been murdered, and that this sordid violence had occurred in a communist state. By contrast, the public would not have seen mention of the names of Father Augusto Ramirez Monasterio, Father Superior of the Franciscan Order in Guatemala, murdered in November 1983, or Father Miguel Angel Montufar, a Guatemalan priest who disappeared in the same month that Pope Yahushko was killed in Poland, or literally dozens of other religious murder victims in the Latin American provinces, who were sometimes given substantial coverage in the local press of the countries in which the murders took place. In fact, none of the extremely prominent victims of murder in Latin America, including Archbishop Romero and the four American churchwomen, received anywhere near the attention accorded Pope Yahushko. We will show later that the quality of treatment of the worthy and unworthy victims also differed sharply. While the coverage of the worthy victim was generous with gory details and quoted expressions of outrage and demands for justice, the coverage of the unworthy victims was low-keyed, designed to keep the lid on emotions and evoking regretful and philosophical generalities on the omnipresence of violence and the inherent tragedy of human life. This qualitative difference is already apparent in placement and editorializing. 10 front-page articles on Pope Yahushko is a statement about importance, as is the fact of 3 editorials denouncing the Poles, without a single editorial denunciation for the murders of the unworthy victims. By comparing these, we can see that for every media category, the coverage of the worthy victim, Pope Yahushko, exceeded that of the entire set of 100 unworthy victims taken together. We suspect that the coverage of Pope Yahushko may have exceeded that of all the many hundreds of religious victims murdered in Latin America since World War II, as the most prominent are included in our 100. We can also calculate the relative worthiness of the world's victims as measured by the weight given them by the U.S. mass media. The worth of the victim Pope Yahushko is valued at somewhere between 137 and 179 times that of a victim in the U.S. client states. Or, looking at the matter in reverse, a priest murdered in Latin America is worth less than 1/100 of a priest murdered in Poland. The claim is sometimes made that unworthy victims are so treated by the U.S. mass media because they are killed at a great distance and are so unlike ourselves that they are easy to disregard. Poland, however, is farther away than Central America, and its cultural and business links with the United States are not as great as those of Latin American countries in general. 3 of the religious victims among the 23 murdered in Guatemala were American citizens, a consideration that failed to light a fire under the media. Even the 4 American churchwomen raped and murdered by members of the Salvadoran National Guard failed to elicit attention comparable to that accorded Pope Yahushko. Their relative valuation by the New York Times was less than 1/10 of that of the Polish priest, and we will show later that the coverage of these American victims displayed considerably less outrage and passion than that of Pope Yahushko. The coverage of Pope Yahushko was somewhat inflated by the fact that his murderers were quickly tried, and in a trial that American reporters could freely report. Almost every murder of the Latin American victims was carried out by official or paramilitary forces in crimes that were never investigated or prosecuted under law, and were on occasion even subject to actual official cover-ups, as we describe later in connection with Romero and the four church women. Only in the case of the four murdered American women in El Salvador was there sufficient pressure to force some kind of investigation and legal process. As we will see, the legal process was barely noted by the mass media, in contrast with their intense interest in the Popiushko trial, and the press did not comment upon or explore the significance of the fact that there was a relatively serious trial in totalitarian Poland, while state murders were being carried out on a daily basis without any investigations or trials of the murderers in a number of countries within the U.S. sphere of influence called fledgling democracies. 2.1.2. Coverage of the Popiełuszko Case. Jerzy Popiełuszko was an activist priest and a strong supporter of the Solidarity movement in Poland. In an effort to eliminate or intimidate him, members of the Polish secret police abducted him on October 19, 1984. He was beaten, bound, and gagged, and eventually thrown into a reservoir. His body was found several days later. In the furor that ensued, the police directly involved in the killing were quickly identified and were eventually tried and given stiff jail sentences. As we have seen, the level of attention given to the case in the United States was very great. The quality of coverage was also extremely well designed to score political points and contrasts sharply with quality of coverage of unworthy victims. 2.1.2a. Fullness and reiteration of the details of the murder and the damage inflicted on the victim. The coverage of the Popiełuszko murder was notable for the fullness of the details regarding his treatment by the police and the condition of the recovered body. What is more, these details were repeated at every opportunity. The condition of the body was described at its recovery, at the trial when the medical evidence was presented, and during the testimony of the perpetrators of the crime. At the trial, the emotional strain and guilt manifested by the police officers were described time and time again, interspersed with the description of how Popiełuszko pleaded for his life and evidence of the brutality of the act. Numerous unflattering photos of the policemen on trial were presented, adding dramatic detail in support of the image of police viciousness. In the courtroom, the guilty police sit, one with a nervous tic on the right side of his face that caused his dark mustache to twitch uncontrollably, with tear-filled testimony that gave the trial some of its most dramatic moments. Time, February 18, 1985. The police weep openly or bow their heads in the face of the grisly evidence. Popiełuszko himself was humanized, with descriptions of his physical characteristics and personality that made him into something more than a distant victim. In sum, the act of violence and its effects on Popiełuszko were presented in such a way as to generate the maximum emotional impact on readers. The act was vicious and deserved the presentation it received. The acts against the unworthy victims were also vicious, but they were treated very differently. 2.1.2b. Stress on indignation, shock, and demands for justice. In a large portion of the articles on the Popiełuszko murder, there are quotations or assertions of outrage, indignation, profound shock, and mourning, and demands that justice be done. Steady and wholly sympathetic attention is given to demonstrators, mourners, weeping people, work stoppages, masses held in honor of the victim, and expression of outrage, mainly by non-official sources. The population continues to mourn, public outrage mounted. The Pope is deeply shaken, and even Jaruzelski condemns the action. The net effect of this day-in, day-out repetition of outrage and indignation was to call very forcible attention to a terrible injustice, to put the Polish government on the defensive, and probably to contribute to remedial action. 2.1.2c. The search for responsibility at the top. In article after article, the U.S. media raised the question, how high up was the act known and approved? By our count, 18 articles in the New York Times stressed the question of higher responsibility, often with aggressive headlines addressed to that point. A number of articles bring in a Soviet link. Lawyer seemingly implies a Soviet link in slaying of priest, January 31, 1985. And Michael Kaufman of The Times twice manages to drag in the plot to kill the Pope, which the U.S. press, led by the New York Times, had been trying to tie in with the Soviets and Bulgarians. These links to the Soviet Union and the Bulgarian connection are established by finding someone who says what the reporter and his paper want to dredge up. In no case was there a trace of supportive evidence. Time, Newsweek, and CBS News played the same game of aggressively raising question about hints of a contract from the top, Time, and keeping the lid on murder, Newsweek. And Time raised questions about possible Soviet involvement as well as the Bulgarian connection. 2.1.2d. Conclusions and follow-up. The New York Times had three editorials on the Popiełuszko case. In each, it focused on the responsibility of the higher authorities and the fact that a police state is especially responsible for the actions of its police. Murder is Poland, October 30, 1984. It freely applied words like thuggery, shameless, and crude to the Polish state. The fact that police officers were quickly identified, tried, and convicted, it attributed to the agitation at home and abroad that put a limit on villainy. This is a good point, and one that we stress throughout this book. Villainy may be constrained by intense publicity. But we also stress the corresponding importance of a refusal to publicize and the leeway this gives murderous clients under the protection of the United States and its media, where the impact of publicity would be far greater. The Times also fails to note the contrast between murderous Poland and murderous El Salvador. In the latter country, no murders of Salvadorans by the security forces or death squads connected to them have ever resulted in a trial. The absence of such a comparison, as well as the failure of the Times to produce an editorial entitled Murderous El Salvador, illustrates how a serviceable terrorism is protected in a propaganda mode. 2.2. Rutilio Grande and the Unworthy 72. The Unworthy 72 on Penny Lernew's list of martyrs were subject to a grand total of 8 articles in the New York Times, 1 in Newsweek, and none in Time, and they were never mentioned on CBS News in the years of index coverage, 1975 to 78. A total of 7 names on the Lernew list were mentioned in the 8 Times articles, and 2 different ones were discussed in Newsweek, which means that 63 of the murders were blacked out entirely in these important media vehicles. None of the 8 articles in the New York Times had any details or dramatic quality that might evoke sympathetic emotion. They described the murders as remote events in a distant world, but that is a matter of editorial choice. The drama is there for the asking, only the press concern is missing. The savageries inflicted on worthy and unworthy victims, as depicted in the New York Times. Worthy victims. Jerzy Popiełuszko, a Polish priest, murdered on October 19, 1984. 1. Account at finding of body. The sources who saw the priest's body on Tuesday said it was badly bruised, indicating he had been beaten after he was kidnapped on a highway near the town of Torun. The autopsy also showed that Father Popiełuszko had been gagged at the mouth and apparently tied with a rope from neck to feet so that if he struggled, he would strangle himself, they said. The sources said they could not confirm reports quoting members of the slain priest's family as saying he had suffered injuries to his jaw and skull. December 29, 1984. 2. Account at trial of murderers. The film showed clearly that the priest's bent legs were tied to a noose around his neck in such a way that if he straightened them, he would be strangled. The rope binding his hands had evidently come loose in the water. Several gags had also worked free and lay covering his clerical collar and the front of his cassock. From his legs hung a sack of rocks that, according to earlier testimony, had been carried all over Poland for the week that the 3 assailants were pursuing the priest. When the cameras were trained on the priest's face, the narration by a police officer at the reservoir declared that there are clear signs of beating. This was confirmed by medical evidence offered Thursday by Dr. Maria Beardy, a pathologist who said Father Popiełuszko had been struck more than a dozen times with a club. January 26, 1985. unworthy victims. Michael Jerome Cipher, an American priest murdered in Honduras. The bodies were found in a dynamited well on an eastern Honduran estate. July 19, 1975. Note, there was no arrest or trial. Jaime Alsina, a Spanish priest of the Catholic Action Workers Movement, following his arrest in Chile. Several days later, a body with 10 bullet holes in the back was found in the Mapocho River. A Spanish consul identified the body as that of Father Alsina, October 1, 1973. Note, there was no arrest or trial. Archbishop Oscar Arnulfo Romero, murdered in El Salvador on March 24, 1980. Archbishop Romero was killed by a sniper who got out of a red car, apparently stood just inside the door of the chapel of the Divine Providence Hospital, fired a single shot at the prelate, and fled. The bullet struck the archbishop in the heart, according to a doctor at the hospital where the prelate was taken. March 25, 1980. Note, there was no arrest or trial. Maria Rosario Godoy de Cuevas, secretary of the Mutual Support Group, murdered in Guatemala on April 4, 1985. The body of the secretary of the support group for families of the detained and disappeared in Guatemala was found Friday in a ravine 9 miles south of Guatemala City, according to a spokesman for the group. The bodies of her brother and young son were also in the car. April 7, 1985, page 5. Note, there was no arrest or trial. Jean Donovan, Ida Ford, Dorothy Kazel, and Maura Clark, four American women murdered in El Salvador, December 4, 1980. 1. Account at the finding of the bodies. Witnesses who found the grave said it was about 5 feet deep. One woman had been shot in the face, another in the breast. Two of the women were found with their blood-stained underpants around their ankles, December 5, 1980. 2. Account at the trial of the murderers. No description was given, although medical testimony was presented to the court. The murder of one of the 72, Father Rutilio Grande, was an important landmark in the escalation of violence in El Salvador, and in its effect on the newly appointed conservative Archbishop of San Salvador, Oscar Romero. Rutilio Grande was a Jesuit, the pastor of Aguilares, and a progressive who helped organize peasants in self-help groups. He was strongly opposed by the local landlords, police, and military commanders, but he was a national figure in the Salvadoran church and was a friend of the archbishop. Rutilio Grande was shot to death, along with a teenager and a 72-year-old peasant, while on his way to Mass on March 12, 1977. According to a church autopsy, the bullets that riddled the priest were of the same caliber as the Manzer guns used by the police. By coincidence, all telephone communications in the area were cut off within an hour of the triple assassination. Police patrols normally active in the region mysteriously disappeared. Archbishop Romero wrote to the president of El Salvador, Arturo Armando Molina, urging a thorough investigation, which was promised. A week later, the church having established that it was probably police bullets that had killed the three victims, Romero wrote a harsh letter to Molina, noting the absence of a promised official report and pointing out that comments, many of them unfavorable to your government, have been made. With continued inaction, Romero threatened to refuse church participation in any official government event unless the murders were investigated and the killers brought to justice. Romero's biographer writes, 6 weeks later, the lawyer chosen by Romero to follow the case reported an embarrassing and clear indifference toward the investigation on the part of state organizations. A suspect ordered arrested by a judge was living unconcernedly in El Paisnal, and no one had ordered the bodies exhumed and examined. The bullets are still in the graves. Rutilio Grande's murder followed a series of forcible expulsions of foreign clergy by the Molina government and several earlier murders of church personnel. Romero and the clergy deliberated at great length on their course of action in response to this escalation of the violence against them. They tried to get out their messages of concern, but many were not heard because of newspaper censorship. They finally decided to take dramatic action. Temporary school closings, and implementation of the previously mentioned threat to refuse to support the government and other power groups on official occasions. This entire package of murder and church response was hardly lacking in drama and newsworthiness. Yet murder, the confrontation of the desperate church with a repressive state, and the dramatic acts carried out to try to mobilize support in its self-defense were subject to a virtual blackout in the U.S. mass media. The murder of Rutilio Grande was mentioned in Newsweek, Priests in Peril, August 1, 1977, but it never once reached the audiences of the New York Times, Time, or CBS News. This was important in allowing the terror to go on unimpeded. To paraphrase the New York Times editorial on murderous Poland, no publicity and agitation, no containment of terror. 2.3. Archbishop Oscar Romero. The murder of Archbishop Oscar Romero, the highest Catholic Church official in El Salvador, was big news, and its political implications were enormous. At the time of his murder, Romero had been the foremost and most outspoken critic of the policy of repression by murder being carried out in the U.S.-supported military government. In his last sermon, he appealed to members of the army and security forces to refuse to kill their Salvadoran brethren, a call that enraged the officer corps trying to build a lower-class military that was willing to kill freely. Romero had been placed on right-wing death lists and received threats from the right wing, which from the beginning had been closely linked to the army and intelligence services. Only a few weeks prior to his murder, he had written a forceful letter to President Jimmy Carter opposing the imminent granting of U.S. aid to the junta as destructive of Salvadoran interests. The Carter administration had been so disturbed by Romero's opposition to its policies that it had secretly lobbied the Pope to curb the archbishop. Romero, in short, was not merely an unworthy victim. He was an important activist in opposition to the local alliance of army and oligarchy and to U.S. policy in El Salvador. The U.S. media's news coverage of the archbishop's murder and its follow-up reflected well his threatening role, reaching new levels of dishonesty and propaganda service in their coverage of this and related events. 2.3.1. Details of the murder and public response. The details of the Romero murder provided by the U.S. mass media were concise. While there were expressions of shock and distress, there were very few quotations and expressions of outrage by supporters of Romero. There were no statements or quotations suggesting that the murder was intolerable and that the guilty must be found and brought to justice. The New York Times had no editorial condemning or even mentioning the murder. It was quickly placed in the larger framework of alleged killings by both the left and the right that were deeply regretted by Salvadoran and U.S. officials. 2.3.2. The propaganda line. A reformist junta trying to contain the violence of right and left. The Salvadoran and U.S. governments contended at the time of Romero's murder that the killing going on in El Salvador was being done by extremists of the right and the left, not by the Salvadoran armed forces and their agents, and that the government was trying its best to contain the killings and carry out reforms. John Bushnell of the State Department stated before a House Appropriations Committee that there is some misperception by those who follow the press that the government is itself repressive in El Salvador, when in fact the violence is from the extreme right and the extreme left, and the smallest part of the killings come from the army and security forces. This statement was a knowing lie, contradicted by all independent evidence coming out of El Salvador and refuted by Archbishop Romero on an almost daily basis. In his letter to Carter sent on February 17, 1980, the Archbishop pointed out that aid to the junta had resulted in increasing repressive violence by the government, amassing a total dead and wounded far higher than in previous military regimes. And Romero explained to Carter that the idea that the junta was reformist was a myth, that neither the junta nor the Christian Democrats govern the country, but rather power is in the hands of the army, serving itself and the oligarchy. What gave Bushnell's statement a certain credibility was the fact that there had been a reformist coup by young army officers in October 1979, and liberals and progressives entered the early junta. However, as Raymond Bonner points out, the young progressive officers who carefully plotted the coup lost control of it as swiftly as they had executed it. Their ideals and objectives were subverted by senior, more conservative officers who had the backing of U.S. Ambassador Devine and the U.S. Embassy in El Salvador and key Carter administration officials in Washington. The progressive elements on the junta found themselves entirely without power and gradually exited or were forced out, along with large numbers from the cabinet and administration. José Napoleón Duarte joined the junta in March to serve as a fig leaf and public relations agent of the army, but all those who were not satisfied to serve in that role departed. Once the old guard military had seized control from the progressive officers in October 1979, it began a general war of extermination against all progressive individuals and organizations in El Salvador. By the end of May, church sources reported 1,844 civilian deaths already in 1980, a figure that reached 10,000 by the end of the year, almost all at the hands of the government. A guerrilla war was forced on the center and left by the policy of unconstrained violence of the Carter-supported government. The government was not centrist and reformist. It was a military regime of the right, closely linked to the terrorist force ORDEN and the death squads, and it used them regularly as proxies. The paramilitary groups were not uncontrollable. They were doing what the army wanted them to do. The paramilitary forces and death squads of El Salvador had extensive interlocking relationships with the official military and security forces and their U.S. counterparts. There was a revolving door of personnel, close cooperation in sharing information, funding of the paramilitary groups by the official forces, and a division of labor between them. The paramilitary did jobs for which the official forces wished to disclaim responsibility. Although the paramilitary group ORDEN was formally abolished at the time of the October 1979 coup, it was secretly maintained and had a close relationship with the regular military establishment. According to one detailed account, the reformers had officially abolished ORDEN, the old information network, but military officers suspicious of the young reformers secretly re-established and expanded much of the old intelligence system into a grassroots intelligence network that fed names of suspected subversives to military and paramilitary death squads. 4 days after the coup, D'Aubuisson said in an interview, he was assigned by members of the high command to help reorganize ANSESOL, an intelligence communication network, inside a military compound under the chief of staff's office, out of the reach of civilians in the new junta. This secret assignment of D'Aubuisson was confirmed by junta member Colonel Jaime Abdul Gutierrez and then Deputy Defense Minister Colonel Nicholas Carranza. The U.S. mass media, however, followed the Bushnell formula virtually without deviation. There was a civil war between extreme right and leftist groups, New York Times, February 25, 1980, and the seemingly well-meaning but weak junta was engaging in reforms but was unable to check the terror. Time, April 7, 1980. The U.S. mass media had featured heavily the reformist character of the revolutionary junta, but they uniformly suppressed evidence of the powerlessness, frustrations, and early resignation of the progressives and their replacement by civilians willing to serve as frontmen for state terror. Román Mayorga, an engineer and university professor who had been the unanimous choice of the original coup plotters, resigned on January 3, 1980, along with Guillermo Manuel Ungo and at least 37 of the highest-ranking government officials, including the heads of all government agencies. But for the media, these events never happened, and the junta was still a weak centrist government beset by implacable extremes. New York Times editorial, April 28, 1980. Not a right-wing government of massacre. Robin K. Anderson points out that none of the networks reported the final resignation of the junta members. Even CBS, which had reported at length on the appointment of Román Mayorga, failed to report his resignation or any of the others. For television news viewers, these political developments never happened. Television news coverage omitted every reference to this all-important political power struggle that could have accounted for the abuses that continued. The civilian lack of control and even their resignation had no effect on the way in which the news characterized the junta. It continued to be labeled moderate, and the Salvadoran government has continued to be moderate and centrist up to today. Other media suppressions aided in bolstering the myth of the neutral junta standing between the extreme right and the extreme left. On March 29, 1980, the New York Times carried a Reuters dispatch noting the resignation of three high Salvadoran officials who, according to the article, resigned last night in protest against the junta's inability to halt violence by leftist and rightist forces. The preceding day, an AP dispatch recorded the same resignations, but without any explanation of the reasons for this. One of the resigning officials, Undersecretary of Agriculture Jorge Alberto Villacorta, issued a public statement saying that, "I resigned because I believed that it was useless to continue in a government not only incapable of putting an end to the violence, but a government which itself is generating the political violence through repression." Recently, in one of the largest states taken over by the agrarian reform, uniformed members of the security forces, accompanied by a masked person, pointed out the directors of the self-management group, and then these individuals were shot in front of their co-workers. It can be determined from the statement that the reference in the Reuters dispatch to protest against the junta's inability to halt violence by leftist and rightist forces is a gross misrepresentation, and it is evident that an honest transmission of Villacorta's statement would have contradicted the propaganda line. At Archbishop Romero's funeral on March 30, 1980, where many thousands gathered to pay tribute, bomb explosions and gunfire killed some 40 people and injured hundreds more. The version of the event provided by U.S. Ambassador Robert White and the Salvadoran government was that armed terrorists of the ultra-left sowed panic among the masses and did all they could to provoke the security forces into returning fire, but the discipline of the armed forces held. Joseph Triester's account in the New York Times quotes Duarte that the violence was from the left. It also quotes a junta statement that the army was strictly confined to its barracks, and Triester says, there was no sign of uniformed government forces in the plaza before or during the shooting. No other version of the facts is mentioned. However, a mimeographed statement on March 30th, signed by 22 church leaders present at the funeral, claimed that the panic had been started by a bomb thrown from the National Palace, followed by a machine gun and other shots coming from its second floor. This account was suppressed by Triester and was never mentioned in the New York Times. In a follow-up article of April 7, 1980, Triester repeats that on March 30th, the junta ordered all military forces into their barracks, and that they obeyed even though they knew leftists with weapons were pouring into the central plaza. Triester asserts this government claim as fact, and he continues to suppress sources and evidence that contradict this government allegation. He also fails to explain why the leftists would indiscriminately shoot their own people paying homage to the archbishop. The title of Triester's article of April 7, 1980 is "Slaying in Salvador Backfires on Rebels." The article reads as follows. The murder of Archbishop Oscar Arnulfo Romero 2 weeks ago and the killing of 30 at his funeral may have benefited rather than hurt the ruling civilian military junta in the view of many diplomats, businessmen, and government officials. The extreme right is being blamed for the killing of the archbishop, and the extreme left is being blamed for the shooting and bombing that turned the crowded central plaza into chaos as Archbishop Romero was being eulogized. It's not so much that the junta gained, said Robert E. White, the United States ambassador to El Salvador, but that its opponents on the extreme right and left have lost prestige. The net result is a boost in prestige for the junta. We may note how the title of the article transforms the murder of the leader of the dissident forces, and then of his followers at the funeral, from a moral issue deserving outrage into a question of political advantage, and turns that against the rebels. It would be hard to imagine the New York Times publishing an article on Popiełuszko headed "Slaying in Poland Backfires on Solidarity Movement," featuring perhaps the playing up by the official press of demonstrator aggressiveness or violence. Note also how the question of identifying the killer of Romero and the government's obligation to seek justice has been pushed into the background. Finally, there is the statement that the extreme left is being blamed for the deaths in the plaza. Use of the passive voice allows Triester to avoid specification of just who is blaming the extreme left. He mentions as his sources for the article as a whole many diplomats, businessmen, and government officials. He doesn't even pretend to have talked to ordinary Salvadorans or church representatives. but his only citation near the statement that the extreme left is being blamed is the then U.S. Ambassador Robert White. By relying only on government handouts and carefully avoiding readily available conflicting evidence and alternative views, the Times once again found the means of applying the usual formula of a deadly right offsetting a deadly left, with the junta favored by the U.S. government once more placed in the middle with enhanced prestige. 2.3.3 Misrepresentation of Romero's Views. As we noted earlier, Romero was unequivocal in laying the blame for the violence in El Salvador on the army and security forces, and he viewed the left and popular groupings as victims provoked into self-defense by violence and injustice. The people's organizations, he told Carter, are fighting to defend their most fundamental human rights against a military establishment that knows only how to repress the people and defend the interests of the Salvadorian oligarchy. And in his diary, Romero completely repudiated the idea that the army was reacting to somebody else's violence. The security forces are instruments of a general program of annihilation of those on the left who by themselves would not commit violence or further it were it not for social injustice that they want to do away with. Thus, Joseph Treister's statement on the front page of the New York Times that Romero had criticized both the extreme right and the extreme left for widespread killing and torture in El Salvador, March 31, 1980, is straightforward lying. Romero never accused the left of torture or widespread killing. He never equated the right and the left, and he was quite clear that the government, an agent of the right, was the primary killer. In this respect, Romero's perception, essentially the same as that privately conveyed to the press by the U.S. government, was grossly falsified in public by both the government and press. Interestingly, a year later, in an article marking the anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Romero, Edward Schumacher of the Times noted that under Romero's successor, Archbishop Rivera y Damas, the church has moved to a more centrist position in the civil war between the government and the guerrillas. Of course, if the church now takes a centrist position, as opposed to its position under Romero, this constitutes an admission that the theme played by Treister and the Times a year previously of an even-handed Romero was a lie, which it was. Is it possible that the Times always finds the church in the middle and is lying 1 year later as well? The question must remain open, as his successor has been more circumspect than Romero. The willingness of the right wing and the army to murder people like Romero might have affected Archbishop Rivera y Damas's ability to speak his mind freely and forced public caution. The point does not arise for Schumacher and the Times. 2.3.4 The Loss of Interest in Responsibility at the Top. With Pope Yawushko, the media tried hard to establish that there was knowledge of and responsibility for the crime at higher levels of the Polish government. Soviet interest and possible involvement were also regularly invoked. With Romero, in contrast, no such questions were raised or pressed. The media did note that Romero opposed aid to the Salvadoran junta, which Carter provided anyway, but they failed to convey the depth of his hostility to U.S. policy and the importance of his oppositional role, although it was far more threatening to U.S. policy than Popiełuszko was to the Soviet Union. The press never mentioned the special emissary sent by Carter to the Pope in an attempt to bring Romero into line, or the fact that the head of the Jesuit order in Central America was called to Rome, probably in response to this U.S. pressure. The media also suppressed Romero's appeal to the military to refuse to kill, a fact that would have made much clearer how strongly opposed he was to the official policies and how convenient his murder was to the rulers of El Salvador. Although Romero was far and away the most important establishment figure aligned with the popular movements, the media pretended at first that the affiliation of his killers was a complete mystery. The Washington Post supposed an equal likelihood of a left or right-wing source, and the Miami Herald noted on March 27th that both stood to benefit from any chaos his death might have created. No American paper suggested that Popiełuszko might have been murdered by Solidarity sympathizers to discredit the Polish government. This foolishness was the minority position. The bulk of the press suggested that the killer was probably a rightist, but of obscure connection. The reliable Duarte suggested that the killing was too professional to be indigenous. It must have been a contract job from the outside. This view was dutifully repeated in the New York Times, Time, Newsweek, and CBS News. If, as seemed very likely, the killer was a Salvadoran rightist or someone in their employ, what was his connection, if any, with the army and security forces? We saw earlier that the linkages between the death squads and the army were close. There was at least some degree of common command, shared operations, and mutual protection. Could the killer have been a member of the armed forces? Given the links of the army to the paramilitary forces, wasn't it likely that they knew who killed Romero? The U.S. mass media did not raise, let alone press, these questions. When D'Aubuisson's link to the murder became public knowledge, the media failed to make this a big issue, and his close relations to the official forces were not examined and discussed. This is evidence of a propaganda system at work. Any possible U.S. connection to the crime was, of course, far out and could not be raised in the U.S. media. That we don't do this sort of thing is an ideological premise of the patriotic press, no matter what the facts of recent history tell us. But still, the question might have been raised whether the environment that the United States was helping to create in El Salvador, training and aiding a murderous army whose violence had driven Romero to passionate opposition, made the United States indirectly guilty of the murder? The press never discussed this point either. The Times quotes Secretary of State Cyrus Vance on the murder. 2 weeks ago, I wrote the Archbishop and said, "We share a repugnance for the violence provoked by both extremes that is taking the lives of innocent people. We deplore the efforts of those seeking to silence the voices of reason and moderation with explosives, intimidation, and murder." The paper points out that the letter from Vance was in reply to Romero's appeal to cease supplying arms. The article failed to include the gist of Romero's argument, and it did not quote that part of Vance's letter that rejected the Archbishop's appeal. The report also did not take note of Vance's serious misrepresentation of the Archbishop's position when he says that we share a repugnance for both extremes. Romero attributed the killings to the army and the right, not both extremes. We may note also that Romero was victimized by the very forces that Vance supported, and Romero's forecasts seemed to be vindicated by his own murder. There is no hint in the account of any irony or criticism of Vance and his associates. Here the press cannot plead lack of knowledge. As later conceded, the media knew very well that the security forces were the source of the violence. 2.3.5 Murder Unavenged or Triumphant. The assassins of Archbishop Romero were never officially discovered or prosecuted, and he joined the ranks of the tens of thousands of other Salvadorans murdered without justice being done. But in contrast with Popiewuszko, the U.S. mass media seemed quite uninterested in who committed the act or in demanding just retribution. Subsequently, a great deal of evidence became available showing that Roberto D'Aubuisson was at the center of a conspiracy to murder Romero. On the basis of numerous interviews with Arena Party activists and U.S. officials, and examination of State Department cables, investigative reporters Craig Pies and Lori Beckland claimed in 1983 that D'Aubuisson had planned the assassination with a group of active-duty military officers who drew straws for the honor of carrying out the murder. Former Ambassador Robert White, who had access to State Department cables and other inside information during his tenure in office, also stated before a congressional committee in February 1984 that, beyond any reasonable doubt, D'Aubuisson had planned and ordered the assassination of Archbishop Romero, and White gave details on the planning meeting and the subsequent execution of the trigger man to keep him quiet. Further evidence of D'Aubuisson's involvement in the murder came to light with the confession of Roberto Santibanez, a former high official in Salvadoran intelligence. According to Santibanez, the murder of Romero was planned and carried out by D'Aubuisson with the aid of former National Guardsmen of Somoza, but under the protection of General Garcia and Colonel Carranza. Pies and Becklin's informants also indicated that Daubuisson was a subordinate and political ally of Carranza, who was the number two man in the Salvadoran military until his ouster under U.S. pressure in December 1980. Carranza then moved over to head the Treasury Police. Daubuisson also worked with the National Guard's G2 Central Intelligence Office while the Guard was headed by General Eugenio Vides Casanova. Pies and Becklin write that during the time Vides commanded the Guard, active duty military officers working with the G2 were linked in State Department cables to the March 1980 assassination of Archbishop Oscar Arnulfo Romero. Note that Vides Casanova became Minister of Defense, the post he still holds under the Duarte government. In short, there was substantial evidence concerning the identity of Romero's murderers, and there were significant links of the murderers to the highest officials of the Salvadoran military establishment. In fact, a judicial investigation in El Salvador headed by Judge Atilio Ramirez quickly pointed a finger at Daubuisson and General Medrano, a U.S. protege in El Salvador. But Ramirez soon fled the country after several threats and an attempt on his life, and active pursuit of the case in El Salvador ended. In exile, Judge Ramirez claimed that the criminal investigation group of the police didn't arrive at the scene of the crime till 4 days after it was committed, and that neither the police nor the Attorney General provided his court with any evidence. He concluded that there was undoubtedly a kind of conspiracy to cover up the murder from the very beginning. Needless to say, Judge Ramirez's testimony was not featured in the U.S. media, nor was the accumulating evidence of Daubuisson's involvement given significant play. It was back-page material at best, treated matter-of-factly, and never put in a framework of indignation and outrage by the use of emotive language or by asking allies of Romero to comment on the evidence, and it never elicited strident demands for justice. To this day, one will find no mention of the fact that the effective rulers of this fledgling democracy are military officers who were closely associated with Daubuisson and his cabal and may well have been implicated in the assassination. After Daubuisson was caught in a raid on May 8, 1980, with documents showing that he was planning a coup and with evidence of his involvement in the murder of Romero, he was arrested and faced with the threat of trial and imprisonment. An assembly of the entire officer corps of the Salvadoran Army, 700 strong, was quickly convened and demanded his release. He was turned loose shortly thereafter with the concurrence of the Minister of Defense. The documents found in his possession dropped out of sight. The security forces also raided the legal aid office of the Archbishop, removing all of their files bearing on the assassination. At the previously mentioned meeting of the Salvadoran Officer Corps, Colonel Adolfo Mahano, the last of the reformers in the reformist junta of 1979, was denounced, and he quickly exited from the junta to be replaced by yet another hardliner. The Army had expressed its solidarity with the hardline death squad right, and the junta was adjusted to meet this new threat to the image of a reformist junta, with Duarte advanced to president, serving as a figurehead for the benefit of Congress and the media to ensure that arms would flow to the killers. The U.S. media gave little notice to this important display and consolidation of the power of the extreme right, and the semi-official vindication of the murderers of Archbishop Romero. This was telling evidence about the nature of power in El Salvador and the fictional quality of the claim that the government was centrist or reformist. Unbiased media would have featured and explained the meaning of this information. But these facts contradicted the Carter-Reagan mythology, so the media predictably remained silent about these events and continued to perpetuate the myth. On November 29, 1980, following the massacre of the leaders of the opposition in San Salvador, The Times suggested that there is a severe challenge to the credibility of the government, but there is no hint that the revolt of May 1980 had changed their view of April 28th, that this was a weak centrist government. The media also adjusted nicely then and later to the rehabilitation of the probable murderer of Romero and his reintegration into the official power structure. As Daubuisson sought high office and eventually became president of the Salvadoran legislature, the U.S. mass media did not focus on his record as the probable organizer of the murder of Archbishop Romero and as the acknowledged leader of the death squads and a mass murderer. Even the open anti-Semitism of this fascist was kept under the rug. We would submit that if an anti-Semite and professional assassin who was suspected of having organized the murder of Pope Yehushko in Poland ran for office and became head of the Polish legislature, there might have been a raised eyebrow or two in the U.S. media. Throughout this period, media coverage adopted a central myth contrived by the government and confined its reporting and interpretation to its basic premises. The moderate government that we support is plagued by the terrorism of the extremists of the left and right and is unable to bring it under control. The U.S. government and the media understood very well that the violence was overwhelmingly the responsibility of both the U.S.-backed security forces, which were and remain the real power in the country, and the paramilitary network they created to terrorize the population. But this truth was inexpressible. To this day, the media maintained the central myth of earlier years, long after having conceded quietly that it was a complete fabrication. Reporting on the prospects for peace in El Salvador, Lindsey Grusin comments that today death squads of the right and left no longer terrorize the population into submission and silence, thanks to the success of President Duarte and his U.S. supporters in moving the country toward democracy, exactly as a propaganda model would predict. 2.4. Coverage of the Salvadoran National Guard's murder of the four U.S. churchwomen and its follow-up. On December 2, 1980, four U.S. churchwomen working in El Salvador, Mara Clark, Jean Donovan, Ida Ford, and Dorothy Kazel, were seized, raped, and murdered by members of the Salvadoran National Guard. This crime was extremely inconvenient to the Carter administration, which was supporting the Salvadoran junta as an alleged reformist government and trying to convince the public and Congress that the government was worthy of aid. While temporarily suspending military aid to El Salvador, the Carter administration sought a quick and low-keyed resolution of the case. It resumed aid at the drop of an announced rebel offensive and, contrary to its promises, before there was any investigatory response by the Salvadoran government. A commission headed by William P. Rogers was quickly sent to El Salvador to inquire into the facts and offer U.S. aid in an investigation. The commission reported that it had no evidence suggesting that any senior Salvadoran authorities were implicated in the murders themselves, but there is no indication that it ascertained this by any route beyond asking the authorities whether they were involved. The commission acknowledged that justice was not thriving in El Salvador, but it proposed no independent investigation, merely urging the Salvadoran junta to pursue the case vigorously. It noted that the junta promised that the truth would be pursued wherever it led anywhere in the country at any level. Rogers was later to concede that perhaps he was a bit optimistic in expecting the Salvadoran junta to pursue the case seriously. With the arrival of the Reagan administration, the already badly compromised concern to find the culprits diminished further, and the dominance of the interest in protecting the client regime in El Salvador became still more overwhelming. It was quickly clear that the whole business could be forgotten, along with the thousands of Salvadorans already killed, except for the demands of public relations. The willingness to support any feasible cover-up was also quite evident. Secretary of State Alexander Haig stated before the House Committee on Foreign Affairs that the evidence led one to believe that the four women were killed trying to run a roadblock, a shameless lie that was soon acknowledged as such by the State Department. The Reagan ambassador to the UN, Jean Kirkpatrick, went Haig one better, suggesting that the four women were political activists for the Frente, as with Haig's statement, an outright lie, hinting quite broadly that they were fair game. Although Kirkpatrick also asserted that the Salvadoran government unequivocally was not responsible for the murders, evidence was soon available that showed that members of the National Guard had killed the four women. The administration then moved to the position that it was clear that the local guardsmen had acted alone. This was asserted and reiterated despite the absence of any supportive investigation, and important leads suggesting the contrary were ignored. A propaganda model would expect that this preferred government explanation would be honored by the mass media, and that in contrast with the Pope Yehushko case, where useful points could be scored by searching for villainy at the top, the mass media would now be less eager to find that which their government was anxious to avoid. The difference between the murder of the four women and the thousands of others uninvestigated and unresolved in El Salvador was that the families of these victims were Americans and pressed the case, eventually succeeding in getting Congress to focus on these particular murders as a test case and political symbol. This forced these killings onto the political agenda. A trial and convictions were ultimately required as a condition for certification and aid to the military government of El Salvador. Both the Reagan administration and the Salvadoran military were thus obligated to see justice done in this one instance. It took 3.5 years for justice to triumph in this one case, with the lid still kept on top-level involvement. It was a challenge to the mass media to present these murders and the delayed and aborted outcome in such a way as to keep indignation low and to downplay the quality of a system that murdered the women and had to be forced to find a set of low-level personnel guilty of the crime, which it took them years to do. The media met this challenge with flying colors. 2.4.1 Details of the Savagery. The finding of Popiewuszko's body was front-page news for the New York Times. In fact, the initial failure to find his body made the front page.